DW Deutsche Welle. World in Progress.
In this edition, why polio eradication can be dangerous for health workers in Pakistan.
There's nothing bad and wrong with the polio vaccination in Pakistan, if the ingredients of the vaccine are halal. But if there's something wrong with the ingredients, then it should be prohibited.
And Irish travellers strive to be recognised as an ethnic group.
Because they're not recognised as an ethnic group within Ireland, they're not really enabled by the government to run their anti-discrimination campaign as anti-racism.
For all this and more, stay tuned. Welcome to World in Progress. I'm Anke Rasper in Bonn. Africa is not expected to meet all 8 of its Millennium Development Goals, or MDGs, by 2015. But that said, the continent has shown remarkable progress. Overall, Africa is doing well in 4 of the goals. Most African countries made progress in achieving universal primary education, for instance, and they made strides towards gender equality and in the fight against big killers on the continent, diseases like HIV/AIDS, tuberculosis and malaria. That's according to a recent report by the African Union, the United Nations and the African Development Bank. With less than 1,000 days before the 2015 deadline for the MDGs, Sarah Steffen takes a look at what has actually been achieved so far.
15 African countries are among the top 20 nations with the greatest progress towards reaching the Millennium Development Goals, or MDGs. Overall, Burkina Faso, Mozambique, Namibia and Rwanda have done really well, says Ayodele Odusola, a policy advisor at the UNDP's Regional Bureau for Africa, who was involved in crafting the report. In terms of empowering women, it's Rwanda that really stands out.
If you look at the issue of the number of women in the national parliament, Rwanda has the largest in the world. It has about 56% of the parliament being women.
Some of the goals go hand in hand. For instance, empowering women can also be achieved by educating young girls. Providing primary education to all children is another target Africa is expected to achieve. According to the report, enrollment rates have risen to over 90% in most of the African countries. Offering school meal programs where children are fed a warm meal and reducing distances to schools help. But it's also important to explain to parents why they should send their kids to school, says Susan Karuti, Regional Education Advisor for the MDG Center at the Columbia Global Centers in Nairobi.
We have structures like the community education workers that go, you know, from door to door or holding community forums. Because the idea is to have community members who understand these families, who know the special needs, in each of the communities.
In addition to enrolling kids early at the right age, it's also important to keep them there so that they can graduate. A lot has been done to prevent mother-to-child transmission, says Maureen Adudens, Regional HIV/AIDS Advisor for the MDG Center. But challenges remain.
We still have to remember and acknowledge the fact that much of the epidemic, or a number of the people who are affected by this epidemic, still remain within Africa. And the prevalence still remains higher among women than men. And so the gender disparities still stand out. Women still account for 60% of new infections within the continent.
Despite the fast pace in racing towards achieving the MDGs, Africa as a whole won't succeed in halving extreme poverty and hunger. If you just look at progress levels, Africa has worked its way up to the leading pack, says Lena Giesbert of the German Institute of Global and Area Studies. But African countries aren't moving forward at the same pace.
Länder wie Ghana oder Uganda, auch Äthiopien oder Ruanda.
Countries such as Ghana, Uganda, Ethiopia and Rwanda have experienced growth that has not been fed by the resource sector alone. Other countries have been left behind in terms of poverty reduction. But one has to differentiate more in terms of sub-Saharan Africa. Little growth and little poverty reduction can be observed in Sahel countries such as Niger, Chad, Mali, or Burkina Faso, as well as other countries in West and Central Africa because of economic and political instability.
Die hier wirklich sehr geringe Erfolge zu verzeichnen haben, besonders durch politische und wirtschaftliche Instabilität.
But Africa has made significant progress even when it comes to those MDGs that are likely not going to be met by 2015, like improving maternal mortality rates. According to the UN's Odusola, rates were reduced by 42%, but they should have fallen by 3/4 instead. He points to Nigeria's Ondo State Safe Motherhood Program, which provides pregnant women with a mobile phone so they can reach nurses and doctors 24/7 and request home visits. Mozambique provides waiting homes for the mother-to-be, Odosola says.
The waiting homes is where you move very, very close to where the hospital is. You create a place where you allow pregnant women to stay about 2 to 3 days before their delivery date. And the moment they have access to this, they have free drugs, free treatment, and free maternal care.
In terms of post-2015 development goals, Odosola says Africa needs to continue to tackle inequality that comes in different shapes. Income inequality, gender inequality, inequality between rural and urban centers. The MDGs are a work in progress, and Africa certainly is on the right track. Sarah Steffen, DW.
We're moving on to South Asia now, where two reports are related to health issues. Pakistan has for a long while been facing challenges to both its internal and external peace and security. But even so, until fairly recently, it was not considered a dangerous country for health workers. However, that is changing. A series of attacks have been made against those administering polio vaccines in the country. At the end of May, gunmen opened fire on female health workers going door to door on an anti-polio drive near the Pakistani city of Peshawar. One worker was killed instantly, the other one died later of injuries. The shooting is the latest in a series of health worker attacks blamed on militants. Malik Ayu Sumbal has been in the area trying to find out what is motivating the attacks on health workers. Andre Leslie presents his report.
Here in this doctor's surgery in Islamabad, children are being vaccinated against polio. The disease is still a real risk here. Together with Afghanistan and Nigeria, Pakistan is one of the last places on the planet where polio still exists at a constant level. The disease, which infects people who consume dirty water, paralyzes parts of the body. It now only affects only a small number of people in Pakistan each year, thanks to an increase in anti-polio vaccinations. But a recent spate of killings by militants targeting polio vaccination workers and their security personnel has made the task of protecting young children in the country more dangerous. Dr. Usman Baluch, chairman at the Institute of Health and Management Sciences in Islamabad, considers the targeted killings to be part of a continuous wave of anti-government terrorism.
If you look at these incidents, you have to ask, why does it happen? Why are schools also attacked? Why are other government officials attacked? It's a form of reaction in which they attack anyone who is a government or international representative. They consider school buildings as places where the army or other guys who attack them stay safe, so they want to destroy the school building itself.
But it's not only anti-government sentiment driving the killings, says Baluch. Many Pakistanis are afraid of what the vaccination might do to their children too.
The situation is such that they do not have ice, fridges or electricity for the vaccine. So the vaccine they provide is useless, and that's why you would find a huge number of people in Pakistan who would say that their kids got infected by polio despite vaccination.
Some Pakistanis still believe the vaccination program is an anti-Muslim campaign by the Western world to sterilize their children. Despite this, many Muslim scholars are vocal supporters of the polio vaccination program. Mufti Dost Muhammad, a scholar from the Red Mosque in Islamabad, says the US's admission of using a fake vaccination drive back in 2011 in Abbottabad to capture wanted terrorist Osama bin Laden was damaging to the anti-polio drive.
There's nothing bad and wrong with the polio vaccination in Pakistan, if the ingredients of the vaccine are halal. But if there's something wrong with the ingredients, then it should be prohibited. The majority of the anger in the northwestern province of Pakistan against polio workers came after the fake vaccination campaign launched by the CIA to kill Osama bin Laden. Because of that, there's still a lot of wariness about polio vaccinations in these areas.
international groups, including the World Health Organization and the UN, have been working on several projects and polio drives in Pakistan for decades. Since the UN launched a campaign to rid Pakistan of the polio virus, there's been a significant dip in the number of cases reported, says Michael Coleman from UNICEF in Islamabad.
Pakistan is very close to eradication. You know, we're down to 9 cases so far this year. Last year, around this time, there was at least 22 cases. 2012 over 2011, there were 58 cases in 2012, down from 198. So, you know, unfortunately, if not for the violence this year and late last year, I think we would be calling polio a good news story.
News reports have said that the two workers killed in this most recent attack had refused to take security forces with them. Still, Coleman says the event has had a huge impact on all the members of international organisations working on such campaigns in Pakistan. But he believes the real setback is the vaccination bans in tribal areas at the moment, which increase the risk of children slipping through the net and not getting a vaccination.
Anywhere we can't have access to children is a setback, whether that's because of bans in North and South Waziristan, for example, whether that's because of violence and that preventing insecurity and, as a result, inaccessibility. That's a setback. I mean, obviously, if we can't reach those children.
The recent dissolution and then reinstatement of the Prime Minister's Special Polio Monitoring and Coordinating Cell has also caused uncertainty amongst NGOs active in polio eradication. Ishbar Maksud works as a paramedic in Islamabad. She says that vaccination workers are confused right now.
The attacks resulted in panic among female vaccination workers. The profession has turned dangerous. More than a dozen polio workers have been killed in the various attacks. The government needs to do more to protect polio workers in Pakistan. Otherwise, nobody will be ready to work for polio eradication in this country.
With the already low wages and the clear security risks, many health workers are reconsidering their options at the moment. On the one hand, they want to be part of the campaign, yet they also want complete assurance for their security. With the occurrence rates well down, the next 6 months will now be crucial if Pakistan wants to eradicate polio for good. Andre Leslie, DW, Bonn.
And we're moving on now to Pakistan's neighbour India, where scientists have now developed a low-cost vaccine that could prevent a severe form of diarrhoea caused by the rotavirus. At just $1 per dose, the oral vaccine Rotavac is a fraction of the cost of existing rotavirus vaccines. It could go a long way to preventing severe diarrhoea and dehydration, which claim the lives of tens of thousands of infants and young children in developing countries each year, in both Asia and Africa. Murali Krishnan reports from New Delhi.
The rotavirus kills almost 500,000 children under the age of 5 each year. India has the highest number of deaths. About 100,000 children die each year from severe diarrhea and dehydration caused by the virus. Neighboring Pakistan and in Africa, Nigeria suffer a combined 80,000 child deaths annually. Vaccines exist and there are 2 doses on the Indian market, but they're relatively expensive at about $18 per dose. So this new vaccine at just $1 per dose could save countless lives in low-resource countries. It was developed in a public-private partnership in India by pediatric scientist Dr. M.K. Bahn and an old friend and colleague from the U.S., Dr. Roger Glass, director of the Fogarty International Center. Their Phase 3 clinical trials involved 7,000 infants in 3 Indian states and showed the vaccine to be safe and effective, even in response to various strains. Dr. Bahn says the vaccine will be a boon for rural India.
Almost 40 to 50% of all severe diarrhea is due to rotavirus. It is now the predominant cause of diarrheal deaths, diarrheal hospitalizations. It's particularly important for us because diarrhea affects poor, and particularly the outcome is worst in them. And for most poor families and women, negotiating hospitals, negotiating doctors, you know, particularly in rural areas, is very, very complex.
His fellow researcher, Dr. Glass, explains that their work was spurred when they discovered a particular strain of rotavirus in newborn babies.
Normally, rotavirus doesn't infect newborns, but this strain did. So the early research together was to show that this infection caused a good immune response, absolutely necessary for a good vaccine, the children who were infected in the newborn ward were protected from subsequent severe disease. So this was a natural immunization that was asymptomatic in those newborns. And that was those observations that led us to develop this and consider this as a potentially very effective vaccine.
The World Health Organization recommends that rotavirus vaccines be included in all national immunization programs. But while the Indian government provides subsidized vaccines for polio, tuberculosis, diphtheria, tetanus, and hepatitis B, it does not include rotavirus vaccines. The two other internationally licensed rotavirus vaccines are available in more than 40 countries, but they remain out of reach for many people in developing countries. Rotavac is cheaper than these existing vaccines and an effective alternative. It is an oral vaccine and would be given to infants in a three-dose course at 6, 10, and 14 weeks of age. India's drug controller body is currently considering whether to approve it. Dr. Glass again.
We not only wanted to have a vaccine that was safe and effective, but we wanted to have a vaccine that was affordable and could be used in the public sector and public programs, because that's where it will reach everyone. There are vaccines licensed in India from the outside. They're quite expensive for the routine Indian, the poor Indian. This is a way to overcome that price hurdle and as a safe and effective vaccine. I think not only could it be helpful here in India, but in many of the developing countries, 90 million children born in low-income countries where most of the deaths occur.
A South Indian-based firm, Bharat Biotech, will offer Rotavac at $1 per dose. It plans to file for licensing in July. K. Vijay Raghavan is the secretary of the Indian government's Department of Biotechnology.
This will now go to the drug controller, who will take the matter into consideration, and we should make sure that we allow them to do this assessment fairly and correctly. India has an effective vaccination program, so the next step would be to take this through licensing to allow it to integrate into the vaccination program and make the largest possible impact. Once we make this impact, we will see all sorts of changes in our society in terms of how this disease affects people, whether it affects them less or differently, and so on and so forth.
If approved, Rotavac will become the first entirely new vaccine developed and approved in India in over 100 years. But there is still much to be done to test its efficacy while reaching out to newborns across the country. Unlike most clinical trials that take place in a hospital setting, in this case, researchers and doctors had to go out to the communities where they recruited appropriate volunteers and monitored their progress. Dr. Glass says this is just the start.
I feel like I'm at a commencement where we've graduated to have something that's effective, but the true impact will only be known in the next couple of years when this is rolled out in the communities of India and where we can actually measure and monitor an impact on child health.
For Dr. Bhan, the experience has given rise to hope that India is on the track to develop a homegrown pharmaceuticals industry.
It has given us tremendous experience through this global partnership to learn how to do these things from discovery to the end product. We have science which is good, we have a generic industry which is good. Not often had the privilege of trying to cover the whole value chain, and this, with the help of some wonderful global partners, was possible to achieve.
Doctors estimate that the entire project costs around $80 million, so its development was far cheaper than most other drugs too. And if all goes well, the vaccines would be available as early as the end of 2013. Murali Krishnan, DW, New Delhi.
You're still listening to World in Progress at DW. Coming up next, a story about Irish travellers striving for recognition. But first, here's Neil King with today's development news.
Globe less peaceful than 5 years ago. The world, especially the Middle East, has become less peaceful than it was 5 years ago, according to the 2013 edition of the annual Global Peace Index, GPI, released this week by the Institute for Economics and Peace, IEP. The trend over the past 5 years is chiefly due to the intensifying civil war in Syria. The number of homicides is also rising, especially in Mexico, Central America, and several sub-Saharan African countries.
In terms of GDP, military spending is also increasing in many nations. Counting the costs, such as budgets for defence and internal security, the impact of violence on the global economy in 2012 came to at least $9.5 trillion, or 11% of gross world product, nearly double the value of the world's total food production. Nicaragua pressing on with Chinese canal deal. Nicaragua is ploughing ahead with a plan to dig a Chinese-funded rival to the Panama Canal across the midriff of the country, despite a lack of details about the $40 billion project. The China-based consortium says it will finance the digging of the 130-kilometer-long canal in exchange for a majority of the earnings. Proponents hope the project could capture 4.5% of world maritime freight traffic and double the per capita gross domestic product of Nicaragua, one of the poorest countries in Latin America. Poorest WTO members win new patent rule waiver. The globe's poorest nations have won an 8-year extension of a waiver on intellectual property rules, but still need to hold talks on the issue of pharmaceutical patents, World Trade Organization officials said on Tuesday. The session of the 159-nation WTO's TRIPS Council, standing for Trade-Related Aspects of Intellectual Property Rights, ruled that the waiver for 34 countries can now run until 2021. The TRIPS agreement, in force since 1995, requires WTO member states to legislate and enforce minimum standards for the protection of intellectual property in order to boost confidence in global commerce. UNHCR and faith-based NGOs to unveil declaration on protecting the forcibly displaced. The UN Refugee Agency and representatives of 25 faith-based NGOs have unveiled a landmark declaration aimed at strengthening protection for the world's more than 40 million refugees. Known as an affirmation of welcome, it sets out principles to guide faith leaders in providing positive environments for refugees and displaced people and combating xenophobia. The text draws upon principles and values shared by religions, including Buddhism, Christianity, Hinduism, Islam, and Judaism.
That was Neil King with a peek at the news. And our last story today takes us to Ireland, where the so-called travellers have lived a mostly nomadic life for at least 1,500 years. What's ironic about the modern Irish travellers is they don't really travel anymore. The Irish government has introduced a host of laws over the years, making it harder for this nomadic group of people to move around the country. But this more settled traveller community is having a hard time finding work, housing and schooling. So to fix this, Irish travellers are petitioning the government to recognise them as an ethnic group. But exactly how would that work? Our correspondent, John Sepulfredo, has been trying to find out, beginning in the west of Ireland.
Some travellers still live in caravans, some even speak the traveller language, although those traditions are beginning to fade quickly. But if there's one tradition still well alive, it's boxing. Take Joseph Ward. While their 10-year-old Irish boys play football or rugby, Joseph spends his Friday night pounding the bag.
Keep your hands up and go in the fight.
And all of his friends, he says, fight as well.
You shut up by talking.
This is the famous Bull McDonough.
Can I just say one more thing to that ginger fool over there? I'm going to fight and I'll beat him. You come into the ring and I'll go on.
So like it's a traveller thing, you box.
This is
the famous. It's like what we do.
In the small west coast town of Chum, about 20 kids warm up for fights, practicing their jabs and footwork. They stop to flex their biceps in the mirror around the club. They hit red and black bags hanging on chains that are bolted to the wooden rafters. One 13-year-old has a brand new tattoo on his shoulder. It's of boxing gloves. The blood from where the tattoo gun punctured the skin is still oozing from his shoulder. Boxing is ingrained in the traveler community. And for years, boxing has been a way for traveler families to solve disputes or even a form of entertainment. As these nomads would travel from place to place around Ireland, they also developed other unique cultural traits.
We have our own language.
That's Bridget Quilligan.
For instance, if I was saying that this man's after coming over from America, I'd say this fiend's after missing over from the Knocklay. You know, so it's like, it's a very lyrical language.
Quilligan is the director of the Irish Traveler Movement. And she says the lyricism also extends to songs, like in this one, called Long, Long Before Your Time.
When I
child like you and a girl I used to know.
It's traveler singer Julia McDonald singing in 2010.
We left and played and sang our merry rhyme. Oh, we were young and happy then, long, long before your time.
Now, public singing like this is actually a commonality that travelers share with settled Irish people. Yet Quilligan says those commonalities are often overlooked. Instead, she says, travelers are generally seen as backwards by the rest of the Irish public.
And that we deserve any kind of racist attack or discrimination that we get.
And there have been racist attacks. For example, this past February, a traveler home was burned to the ground by arsonists. The attack came after a popular politician said he wouldn't want to live near travelers. Other racism is less extreme. Travelers say police are constantly harassing them, and hotels and pubs will bar entry to travelers who are seen as vulgar, wild, hot-headed, and ignorant. Sociologist Ronit Lennon is a professor at Trinity College in Dublin, and she says Irish society holds very firm views about travelers.
They're lazy.
They all do drugs.
They live off welfare.
They steal.
They are dirty.
They won't send their kids to school.
They marry the girls too early.
They won't work.
But can they get work?
Oftentimes the answer is no, as Lenton points out, because of discrimination. Traveler unemployment is almost 50% in some parts of the country. Meanwhile, perceptions about travelers are perpetually reinforced by the media and the government, as both institutions often focus on the higher crime rates in traveler communities while ignoring the high poverty and suicide rates. Lenton calls it a form of institutional racism.
Because they're not recognized as an ethnic group within Ireland, they're not really enabled by the government to run their anti-discrimination campaign as anti-racism.
There are about 15,000 travelers, and they live throughout Ireland, according to the Central Statistics Office. And while where they come from, their origins, are widely disputed, some genetic testing places this unique group of people in Ireland around the 5th century AD. Being a recognized ethnic group would allow travelers avenues for different lawsuits when they're discriminated against. Right now, travelers often find it difficult to get housing because they are recognizable by their last names, names like Ward or Joyce or Collins. And so, many families live on the outskirts of town or in poorly managed public housing. Ethnic status would also allow the travelers to challenge Ireland's anti-trespassing laws at the United Nations and the European Court of Human Rights, according to Quilligan. Those anti-trespassing laws are basically designed to keep travelers from practicing their cultural nomadism. Yet despite this push, and it's been going on for about 20 years to recognize ethnic status, the government has been slow to act. And while surveys show that most travelers support this ethnic status, some prominent leaders don't.
I think it would be very divisive in Irish society.
Martin Ward is a former mayor of Tuam and a notable opponent of ethnic recognition.
People that are prejudiced towards travellers would say, okay, they're not Irish. Now they're looking for to be recognised as a different group of people. And there are people that have kind of weird thinking, you know what I mean?
Ward says it would just make travellers stand out even more in Irish society.
I think what we are an indigenous native group of Irish people. And I think we should be looking for a native Irish status rather than an ethnic, being recognised as an ethnic minority.
People know we're different.
Again, Bridget Quilligan, director of the Irish Travellers Movement.
In terms of traveller ethnicity and in setting us apart, at the moment our difference is vilified. And for anybody and any traveller to say that we should try to work beside people and integrate the best part of ourselves into Irish society is being frank about it, because we have done that. We are doing that.
Ethnic recognition in Ireland, Quilligan says, is a legal means to recognise difference, not separateness. Her organization meets with other traveler groups later this month how to successfully relaunch this decades-old campaign. For DW, I'm John Sepulvedo in Dublin.
And this piece from Ireland wraps up today's edition of World in Progress. Don't forget, you can always keep up with development-related issues at dw.de/globalization. And that's globalization with a Z. And you can listen again or download the podcast at dw.de/worldinprogress. Please do join me again next week at the same time for a new edition of World in Progress. For today, on behalf of the Bonn studio team, Christoph Grove and Marion Wolf, I'm Anke Raspa. Thanks for listening and goodbye for now.